and welcome back to Mallory's Weird World Adventures. Today, I'd love to discuss something really fun and exciting with you guys. Something I've noticed throughout history is that a lot of our legendary figures that we continue to immortalize and tell stories about come from real historical figures. Yet, somehow, throughout time, these figures wildly separate far from who the real person was and turn into these unbelievable legends of people who were nothing like their historical counterparts. For instance, the real Merlin was a bard and in no way this epically magical wizard. Most people believe that he never even really met King Arthur. And Nicholas Flamel, well, he was a writer who wasn't even thought to be an alchemist until close to 200 years after his death when his name reemerged back into the pages of history. Today, we're going to discuss these legends in greater detail and try to figure out what happens from the time of their death until their return in our storybooks. So I'm just going to jump right in here with someone who is likely my favorite example of real life to legend, the Egyptian figure Imhotep. The 1999 film The Mummy has almost surprisingly soared to extreme popularity over the last few years. I must say, I'm not surprised at all. It is one of my absolute favorite movies, so I get it completely. Being a natural history buff and lover of the occult and strange things, I wondered about the real Imhotep and Anaxenamun that inspired the villainous couple of the Mummy films. If you don't know, Universal's original Mummy film from 1932 had Imhotep as the villain, with the heroine of the film being the reincarnation of Anaxenamun. When they decided to redo the franchise in the late 90s, they stuck with the same two characters and more or less made them the villains of the piece, both of them. But Imhotep and Anaxenamun were actually real Egyptian figures. Who were they really? Did they even live at the same time? Let's talk a little bit more in depth about the real Imhotep and Anaxenamun, who they really were, and what they meant to the history of Egypt. While there were records of people practicing medicine throughout the history of ancient Egypt, early records make no mention of any notable physicians. The first ever recorded physician in ancient Egypt was actually Imhotep, though strangely enough, the records only began mentioning him over a century after his death. Imhotep was vizier, or chief minister, high priest of the sun god Ra, and chief builder of the pharaoh Djoser, who reigned from 2667 BC to 2648 BC. As a builder, Imhotep was credited with designing and building the famous Step Pyramid of Djoser at Saqqara and was known for designing and utilizing columns. He was also considered to be the first architect known by name in human history. He was known to be a healer who was responsible for the medical care of thousands of workers who took part in his projects. Due to the records we have on Imhotep, aside from being the first physician of ancient Egypt known by name, he was also the first physician known by name in written history around the world. This led him to be deified and worshipped after his death, as he became known as a demigod who was the inventor of healing. In fact, he was one of the few people in ancient Egypt who became deified after death that wasn't of royal birth. This was next to impossible for a non-royal to achieve, but Imhotep seemed to be so important to Egypt that he broke the norm and became known as a demigod. All in all, Imhotep seemed to be one of the most important minds of not only his time, but throughout the history of the ancient world. He was an excellent builder, an architect, and a physician who seemed to move Egypt forward leaps and bounds while he served as chief minister and vizier. His tomb has still not been found, though archaeologists still are on the hunt for it today. So, all in all, it's rather amusing to me that of all the figures in Egypt's history, Imhotep was taken and used in pop culture as a villain when he was probably one of the most progressive and important minds of Egyptian history. Anaxenamun was perhaps most well known for being the great royal wife of King Tut. The third daughter of a pharaoh Akhenaten and the famous Nefertiti, Anaxenamun is believed to have participated in many governmental and religious functions alongside her parents. After likely marrying her father first after her mother's death, which was normal back in Egyptian royal families, she married King Tut. The couple restored the traditional religion of Egypt back into power after her father had originally abandoned Egypt's primary deities. While historians are not exactly sure, since she was the only known wife of King Tut, they believed that the couple had two stillborn daughters that were buried in the tomb with King Tut, as two fetuses were found in his tomb when it was uncovered. This means that when King Tut died at the age of 19, he left Anaxenamun single and without an heir at roughly 21 years of age. It is believed that she married Ai before disappearing entirely from history, practically without a trace. Scientists uncovered two 18th dynasty queens in tomb KV21 in the Valley of the Kings in December of 2010. DNA tests revealed that one of them may have been an Anaxunamun, which makes sense as the tomb KV63 was speculated to be hers, but it was found with no mummy inside. I'm sure you've already noticed the extreme gap that existed in the time in which these two figures have lived. In reality, Imhotep died well over 1,000 years before Anaxunamun was even born, and being the only prevalent Egyptian figures with those names, it's safe to say that the two never really came close to crossing paths. So why were these two figures plucked from history to grace the screens of our horror films? Perhaps filmmakers just grabbed the names of lesser-known Egyptian figures. Perhaps they picked them as there's a lot of mystery shrouding the two of them. Imhotep was loved and deified after his death, but there was a huge gap of over 1,000 years before that really occurred, and Anaxunamun seemed to have disappeared entirely from history without a trace. Maybe that's why. Who knows why they picked the two figures to be the main characters in the 1932 The Mummy, or why they made them villains in the 1999 remake and its sequel. However, I love the irony in picking one of the greatest minds of his time, the basic father of Egyptian medicine and architecture, and making him the villain in modern pop culture. Whatever the reason, we continue to talk about Imhotep well over 4,000 years after he lived and died, and it's super important here to mention that this gap of time that existed between his death and when he emerged in written history. This tends to happen across history regarding real legendary figures all the time. We're going to talk about another example that this happened with, Merlin. Yes, you heard right. Merlin was likely a real historical figure, though he was not an all-powerful wizard as depicted in fiction, and he actually never really met King Arthur. I know it's disappointing, right? But I think it's important to point out that Merlin has become a legendary figure who transcended time as the tales of King Arthur continue to flourish and move through our generations. But despite the legends, who was the real Merlin, and why do we still remember him today in such a strange way? While there are debates from historians on who the real Merlin could have been, some claim his legend could have been inspired by Ambrosius Aurelianus, and others say it could have been pulled from the Welsh mythological character Gwydion. The general consensus was that Merlin was actually mostly based on the Welsh hermit Myrddin Wyllt. Myrddin was born around 540 and served as the bard and potentially a druidic priest to Gwyndolau. After his king was killed on the battlefield, Myrddin recorded the battle and was awarded a golden torque for it before potentially going mad and retreating into the forest. These accounts also discuss Merlin's later abilities as a seer prior to his death. Historians believe that enough fragments of Myrddin's biography survived time long enough to be put together in The Legend of Merlin by Geoffrey of Monmouth in medieval times. This is when the tales of King Arthur and Merlin first emerged and took fame in 1138. It is also quite possible that why Myrddin was used as a base, pieces of the story of Ambrosius, Gwydion, and other mythical heroes were also melded together to fill in Myrddin's tale and make this character a larger-than-life hero. After all, Merlin was regularly referred to as Merlin Ambrosius, which would also make sense if he were a compilation of Myrddin and Ambrosius Aurelianus. What we do know for sure, however, is that in the 6th century, Britain was ravaged by warfare. Warriors from what is now modern-day Germany had begun invading and claiming territories in Britain. And thanks to the religious strife and a lack of focus that came with it, Britain had a hard time defending off its enemies. We do know that King Gwyndolau was killed by invaders, and the real-life Merlin's emotional elegy for his lost king is one of the oldest Welsh poems in existence. That poem serves as the primary basis for historians who believe that Merlin was real. And we do know that Geoffrey of Monmouth took this to history and inspired his famed tales, and he laid out clues of Merlin's origin stories clearly in his work. While he may not have been an all-powerful wizard, thanks to Geoffrey of Monmouth, Myrddin became Merlin in 1138. Merlin's legacy was born, and he has since continued on as a regular household name throughout the generations. Another interesting figure with a strong disconnect from when he lived and when he died and then became a legend was Nicholas Flamel. Thanks to our societal love of pop culture, It's likely that when I bring up Nicholas Flamel or the Philosopher's Stone, your mind immediately goes to Harry Potter. While it is true that both of these subjects were brought up into the modern eye because of the cultural phenomenon that is Harry Potter, the reality is that Nicholas Flamel was very much a real person, though it's debatable whether or not he actually had a fascination with creating the Philosopher's Stone. So we're going to talk a little bit here about who Nicholas Flamel was and whether or not he actually created the Philosopher's Stone. What's interesting about Nicholas Flamel was that he was absolutely a real person. However, despite the fact that he may have very well dabbled in alchemy in his life, he became a larger-than-life immortal figure in the 17th century, almost 200 years after he died. What we do know about him right off the bat from historical documentation is that he lived in Paris in the 14th and 15th centuries. As a scribe, he ran two shops, and his wife, Perronel, was the reason he was historically known for being wealthy, as she had been married twice before and had inherited both of her late husband's wealth. Flamel and his wife were patrons to churches and the arts, noted for not only having money, but being philanthropic with it as well. We know that Flamel lived well into his 70s. He designed his own tombstone, which can be viewed at the Musée de Cluny in Paris today, and that there is no official documentation stating that he was ever involved in alchemy, pharmacy, or medicine. So how did he blow up as this infamous alchemical figure well after his death? His association to both alchemy and the Philosopher's Stone was all thanks to an alchemical book entitled Livre des Figures, Hieroglyphics, published in Paris in 1612 and later in London in 1624 under the translated title Exposition of the Hieroglyphical Figures. It was specifically thanks to this book that Flamel became an infamous alchemical figure. This book contained a collection of designs supposedly commissioned by Flamel that the book claimed had been lost long after his death until publication. Within the pages, the publisher describes Flamel's search for the Philosopher's Stone in the introduction and claims that he did successfully create it in 1382. This is why people credit Flamel for making the Philosopher's Stone, for being able to turn metals into silver or gold with it, and for achieving immortality. People took this text to heart for well over 100 years until its validity was questioned in 1761 by Etienne Villain. Regardless of the truth of the claim, Flamel had become so legendary in the mid-17th century that he was even referenced in Isaac Newton's journals. Now, to further explain, it's important to understand the basis of alchemy. Alchemy is one of the more well-known studies that has regularly been referred to as an occult topic. It's an ancient philosophy that was practiced in China, India, and Europe, most commonly associated with Hellenistic Egypt. Prior to modern science, many revolutionary men with big ideas sought to change matter from one element to another. Generally, most of the history of alchemy was men trying to turn things into gold through different forms or experimentation. The Philosopher's Stone was a legendary item claimed to be able to do just that. While there are no official documents of Flamel ever having dabbled in alchemy, in the 17th century and beyond, many manuscripts popped up having excerpts of Flamel's writing, which would make sense since he was documented to be a scribe living in Paris centuries prior to the claims. While we can't know for sure, the question becomes, do you believe the manuscripts that popped up to be valid? Many claimed the most infamous piece, Livre des Figures Hieroglyphiques, was a trick by the publisher to create a phenomenon that would sell many copies. If that was the case, it worked, and also caused many other manuscripts to pop up and credit Flamel for his alchemical work. Le Trésor des Trésors is another example, as well as Isaac Newton's journals. Part of what makes his relation to alchemy so unclear is that even if the manuscripts could be traced back officially to Flamel, alchemists generally wrote in codes and symbols that were quite hard to decipher, making it so the ignorant could not understand their works. So deciphering these old texts is already questionable, and there's no official key to do so. I guess we may never really know what occurred in those 200 years when Flamel supposedly died and then was suddenly brought back to life metaphorically through alchemical claims of his work. What's so fascinating is that he seemed to live a pretty average, albeit wealthy life until he died in 1418. Then all was silent until 1612 when he reemerged as an alchemical icon thanks to that book. Now he's become a piece of pop culture and the face, more or less, of alchemy. Isaac Newton, in his quest to create a formula for the Philosopher's Stone, even quoted Flamel in his work. Just like the real Merlin, somehow we create these fantastical figures from real-life people in our societies, and people become remembered as legendary phenomena more than the average person they very well could have been. And Nicholas Flamel is another great example of that. While we know who he had been immortalized as, it's possible we never really find out his true connection to alchemy, if there is any, and if he truly did write those excerpts or not. Now, you may have noticed that in the case of Merlin and Nicholas Flamel, and Imhotep as well, hundreds of years passed between the time of their death and when someone wrote about them. The real person died, was dead for centuries, and then suddenly this more epic, mystical version of themselves arises from the depths of their ashes to grace our myths and legends. It's interesting that the storytellers would pick real people that actually existed, and it's led me to wonder why. So, I have with me here today Damian C. King and James McInerney as they research more about this stuff than anyone else I know, and we're going to have just an open conversation about it.
Why do you think people pick people that actually existed to tell these stories about? What's the value in having...
Oh, it's because that's how it starts. In fact, bards are a big part of this. Back in the day, bards were something that would come into a kingdom for the first time, usually carrying with them stories. Kings used to watch them very carefully, because they wanted to know two things. First, what sort of stories were they telling? Because if they told stories from a neighboring kingdom, they might have them put to death immediately, because what that means is they're actually a propaganda machine for an enemy nation, and they need to be stopped immediately. And if they happen to be good bards and they weren't telling stories from a neighboring nation, they might in fact employ them instead. And they'd say, all right, so here are our local myths, here are our people, here are stories. Come up with something that makes us sound awesome. And besides telling all the people in our kingdom, I want you to travel around and I want you to tell this story to other neighboring kingdoms, which is why they were always on the lookout for bards from enemy nations doing the exact same thing.
I mean, that's one way, but there's actually an even simpler, simple way of explaining it. Human nature is to tell stories. It's actually how we communicate in varying levels of degrees. And the biggest thing that spreads this type of information is a rumor. I mean, everyone has been involved in a rumor that started as something that was true, that happened, and then just after one person tells another person and another person tells another person, human nature is to start to amp it up a little bit. You add a little bit more detail, you add a little bit more cool factor so that when you're telling your story, it sounds bigger than it actually was. And after the story has been told so many, you know, thousands of times, it starts to become this hugely fabricated memory that had a very small basis in truth, and it just continues to spiral in that nature.
It's the $20 factor that, and then I found $20, and if everyone adds something like that to it, is what
Not exactly the and I found $20 thing is a very single point to make something special, but it's more just like, you know, like, oh my gosh, that girl tripped and fell, and then the next person, oh my gosh, that girl, she was like really unsteady on her legs and she tripped and fell. Oh my gosh, did you see that girl? She has zero coordination. Oh my gosh, did you see that girl? Someone pushed her over.
And like, then she was cursed. There was a ghost that did it. And all of a sudden, like, the moment someone adds something like that, it takes on a life of its own. All of a sudden, there's a supernatural angle. And the moment someone adds a supernatural angle, all bets are off.
Yeah, and then if people find it cool, the story continues to be told by just tons of different people. In fact, Jimmy and I were actually discussing this morning mythological creatures. We were talking about how there was a mythological wolf creature that was actually discovered in France. And at first it started off as this, oh, this wolf is prowling and, you know, killing people. And it turned into this wolf as, you know, is the size of a horse and, you know, it's going town to town, killing people and specifically specifying virgins and doing all the, rumors just get out of control. And then they create a mythological creature because, again, human beings are really prone to larger than life stories as a way of communicating things. So I think it's just something cool happened, something that was actually factually interesting to the people around it. And then those stories just continue to escalate and continue to spiral until they become mythological creatures or mythological peoples such as King Arthur and whatnot like that.
Romanticizing can also absolutely happen. The sword is actually one of the easiest ones to point to. I mean, the sword was very popular in the West and the East, and it ultimately had kind of like the same deal with it. People use, like, when you think of a knight, what is the classic weapon of a knight? It's a sword, or at least that's what you think. No, it's not. It's a lance. If you go back in history, it was a lance. But why do we think knight and sword? Well, sword was a sidearm. That was something that they had been using since antiquity. You go all the way back to the Egyptians. They had swords, and they were almost always a sidearm. They're a phenomenal sidearm, something that you keep on your hand when you can't use your spear anymore, which was the most common melee weapon all throughout human history.
Well, actually, and to add to this too, don't forget the dagger is actually a really simple one. Yeah. Everyone always remembers like, a knight always carries a dagger on his side, and people romanticize and go, well, it's for putting a comrade out of danger and stuff like that. But actually, the real reason you had a dagger on you is back then it was your primary cutting tool for when you were going to feasts. So you had a dagger on you, but guess what? A dagger for cooking and for eating. And
so
you could absolutely fight with it because you just had it on you. But now it's this thing where everyone's like, oh, you know, knights carried around daggers and the populace didn't. No, pretty much everyone carried around a dagger because it was the thing you ate with.
You think the separation kind of adds to that too, because we don't know that now. And so now when the tale gets told, we're like, why was that there? And all of a sudden there's an air of mystery because as historians, most people aren't historians. They don't understand those little details. So it becomes a greater tale.
Again, going back into storytelling 101, if the story gets so larger than life that now some things don't make sense, well, the next time that someone goes to tell the story and somebody asks a question, they're just going to make up an answer because we also like to bridge gaps of what we don't know. And if it's a fantastical type of thing that you're saying, you have to say something that makes sense. So kind of bridges get created to just continue perpetuating the story.
Sometimes you don't have an answer, so you say a wizard did it. Yeah. And that was true then, it's true now.
Definitely true for Merlin.
Yeah. And that's exactly it. I mean, there's a lot of people that existed in history. I know there's one that you want to talk about who had a lot of like medical knowledge. So, you know, he was a witch, or he was a wizard, or he was
ancient evil mummy. Or
even he was a holy man. He was a god touched. You know, like people create so many different things to explain something they don't understand.
Yeah, I did go into that earlier in the episode about Imhotep. That's what they're referencing. I'm sure you guys got it. Who was actually the first medical physician of Egypt? The actual first historically written out physician.
So, and therefore, evil mummy that can bring things back from the dead. Yeah.
He was this amazing Renaissance man that was known for so many amazing things during his time frame. Like, he was so ahead of his time. But what is he? Yeah, immortal mummy. That's what everyone remembers.
He wants to bring his girlfriend back, who actually lived 1,000 years after he did. But, you know.
Yeah, these are all facts now.
Clearly facts now. So, I have a question for you guys. Why do you think these people, generally, consensually throughout history, these people live... They disappear, their story kind of disappears from written history for hundreds of years, and then it emerges this great mythical tale. What do you think happens in that timeline where it's just out of the written history?
Well, that's actually very common. It's because the first way of explaining, of storytelling, of, written history wasn't written history. Most people actually weren't literate until kind of the newer ages of mankind. So, I mean, think about it. Like, until the printing press, like, you couldn't even, like, get easy access to written copies of things.
Until the, like, 1900s, you still had, like, vast swaths of just illiterate people.
Yeah, so storytelling or passing things down from generation to generation or even just the word... reaching other peoples, like that's actually how you conveyed information. So the reason people dipped in and out of written history and then came back is that maybe someone did write it down somewhere. It was very difficult. It was a very hard process for them. And so it gets uncovered. Then that story just gets told again. And that's what ends up happening. But in the meantime, probably someone's great, 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 you know, infinity times grandfather has been telling his family line and making sure his family line told the story of the great King Arthur who saved his kingdom that he lived in. And then it just gets passed down to generation because that is how we convey information.
And sometimes allegory just gets lost. Like, it's not understood that something was allegorical. Like, you say that a knight rode out with his eyes aflame or something like that. You know, it's just talking about, like, you know, he was really angry or really focused or something like that. And then, you know, ages later, it's just like, oh, yeah, he had laser vision.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, I got a really specific example. Merrick is one of the knights of King Arthur's Round Table. And they constantly talk about him as the werewolf knight. And so when I first started hearing that, I actually am writing a novel that's about a werewolf knight. Named Merrick, and I started going down that route. But when I did my history and I started digging, I'm like, why was he a werewolf knight? Because nothing in the stories say that he was, like, a werewolf. So I started researching it, and one of the common names for people that had red hair back then was to call them cursed or touched, or they called him a werewolf, because something like that was, like, wolf-blooded or werewolf. It just meant that he had red hair, so he was probably just a red-headed knight that now, into the future, everyone's like, he's a werewolf. It's like, did he have powers? It's like, Yes!
He was kissed by fire.
Yes, exactly.
Honestly, he might not even have been all that notable. It might have just been, like, there was a redheaded knight. A guy just remembered him because of his red hair. Just wrote about him a couple of times. People decided, oh, if he's got red hair, then he's cursed. He was like, oh, if he's cursed, then he's a werewolf.
Yes.
And then it just, like, keeps proliferating in the most ridiculous fashion.
Or when they were writing all the stories about King Arthur's men, you know, maybe all the rest of them were interesting, and that one guy just had red hair, so someone was like, cursed, werewolf. I'll write a story about him being a werewolf.
Oh, absolutely. Especially because, like, with King Arthur stories, there's a clear separation between the myths that were told in England and the ones that were told abroad. A lot of the King Arthur stories that we know, like Le Morte de Arthur, I think that's what it's called, and I probably butchered that name. Anyway, came from France specifically because there were a bunch of French fans of the King Arthur mythos. That includes every story with Tristan. Tristan the Knight, which was a French knight that went over to...
Yeah, he was actually added later.
Absolutely. Like, he did not exist. This is one of the few that I can point at and say he did not exist in any way. He was purely made up. Pure fabrication.
So, I guess, what's your favorite mythological figure that has emerged in legends throughout time, for each of you, it's
lame, but I absolutely, the whole reason I love fantasy is because of Arthurian legend.
Absolutely,
I absolutely love King Arthur, and like, yes, I'm aware that there were three major men that King Arthur's legend was likely based on in creating. I mean, there's, they even made that King Arthur movie like a decade ago that kind of tried to say this is the true story of like King Arthur, and they do that a lot, but King Arthur just spawned so many fantastical tales of this knight and the chivalry and these things. It's like it just spawned so many things that I find wonderful, even if everyone always forgets that chivalry was just a code of conduct for war, not like, you know, open a door for a lady or something. But
I feel like our entire basis of what we think a knight is based on the King Arthur story.
That's correct. That's it is. And that's absolutely what I'm in absolutely love with that style of fantasy. So he might be the most famous, but I have to say that is also my favorite.
Absolutely. Like, honestly, I just kind of have to agree with that. I'll give a bit of a shout out to Charlemagne's 12 peers, especially Sir Roland. I actually really like that guy. And of course, Beowulf, because everybody knows Beowulf.
Yeah,
what a cool guy.
Beowulf's great, but I just, it's hard to knock off the seed of King Arthur. And there are a bunch of incredible legends that still, you know, inspire media and stuff today. And I could literally say a litany of different ones, but it's King Arthur. It's just King Arthur.
Daon, he was actually an agent of the French crown, and no one is sure if Daon was, like, genetically a man or a woman. It's unknown. It is known that Daon went as a man during the first part of his life and then was a woman when he died. That much is known. However, when Daon suddenly declared that Daon was a woman, there was a huge uproar because, of course, you know, this was the Renaissance in France. Like, that sort of thing was unheard of. And everyone said, you know, the King of France, whoever it was at the time, how can you just allow this sort of thing within your kingdom? And all the King of France said at the time was, Daon has saved the French crown more times than you can possibly believe. If Daon declares that Daon was always a woman, I believe her.
Nice. I love that story.
I mean, we talked a lot about mythological people. I mean, I would say that the thing that is most interesting with a lot of this type of mythology is also mythological creatures. Dragons were seen in iconography the world round. I mean, a dragon exists in almost every single culture, from Aztec culture to Chinese culture to European culture. Like, it was a weird mythological creature that spanned the globe. And yeah, some people say, oh, it's because they found bones of dinosaurs and then just created fabrications. Some people say, oh, there were similar creatures that existed at the time, or it's just a very similar, you know, micro fear of humanity to believe in such a thing. But I just find the idea that mythology can spread so worldwide that everyone's got their own iconography of dragons embedded in their own lore, I find that fascinating.
There's a lot of legends like that too, and it's also led people and scientists to kind of look more into the idea of a global consciousness as well, because somehow people on this side of the world and this side of the world and over here on all sides have similar origin stories for different animals, for dragons, for myths, that all kind of relate back to the same thing, and they've never had any connection with each other whatsoever. So it's fascinating to understand why.
And let's also, I'll just very briefly touch on this, but also the religion of it is fascinating. I mean, look at Babylonian myths and legends, which came from the Mesopotamian myths and legends, and they basically evolved from one to the other, including putting an entirely different god on the pantheon, just because he was the main Marduk, he was the main Babylonian god, so he supplanted the previous gods and used the lore to kind of move forward. The Greek and the Roman did the exact same thing. The Roman would classically adopt other religions and adopt the Greek religion, changed it to their own religion so that those people still had something to believe in that was similar to what they believed in, but then changed the mythos to further suit Roman needs. And I find that kind of stuff amazing. I mean, rumor mill mythology and the way that humans tell stories throughout the ages, it's why I'm an entertainer. I think that that kind of stuff is just fascinating.
Fabulous. Alrighty, well, that was Damien and James, who I'm sure you're going to hear on here a lot because, like I said, they're an encyclopedia of useless knowledge and some really cool knowledge, too. And for now, that ends this episode of Mallory's Weird World Adventures podcast. And until I talk to you guys next time, stay weird.